Okay, so if we if some pictures come up on the screen relating to Philippines, I'd begin to share with you a little bit about our future. But first I want to recap a little bit about the past. There is a map of Southeast Asia on this screen behind me. And you can see the Philippines. Can everyone make out the Philippines there? The islands in red, round about the center, or just a little bit above the center. Look like a donkey's head. Can you see the donkey's head? It's very good, isn't it, I think? You see the big red ear at the top and the red mouth at the bottom? And the neck going out? No? Some people say, yes, they see it straight away, and other people stare at it for a long time and say, I don't see any donkey. Anyway, that's the Philippines. Now let's hope my thing works. Okay, turn it on. Isn't that the thing, Jackie? Jackie told me this was easy. Okay. So that's the Philippines, and it's just directly south of Taiwan and southeast of mainland China, a country of over 7,000 islands. The Philippines was colonized by the Spanish in the 16th century. There's a very good series on the history of Spain recently on the BBC, and it was presented by Simon Sebag Montefiore. And it was in the 16th century that Spain was at its peak, at its zenith, as a European power. And Philip II and his and his wife, they were strong missionary Catholic monarchs, and they wanted to spread Spain's influence and the Catholic religion as far across the world as they possibly could. And an explorer called Magellan discovered the Philippines in 1521, but it wasn't until 1565, their fifth expedition to the Philippines, that they actually took control and established a permanent presence in the islands. And because Philip II was king, they named it Philippines. It was after their king. And so Catholicism is today the dominant religious power in the Philippines. More than 80% of the population would say and claim to be Catholic. And you have these some of these terrific Baroque Spanish designed churches from the 17th and the 18th centuries, still dotted around the Philippines. And the Philippines' version of Catholicism, in many ways, if you're in one of these churches and you look around and you think, well, it's like Catholic church that I would see anywhere in Ireland or anywhere else in the world for that matter. And if you were there for a service, it would in many ways resemble what you might see here. But it's also different, of course, because in many ways it's mixed with Filipino culture and Filipino outlook. It's very raucous. It's very noisy. There's lots going on. There's fantastic singing, and there's other rituals and aspects to their worship that is very Filipino that you would not find any other part of the world. So that's still very, very strong and very vibrant in the Philippines. Then in 1898, America had a war with Spain. And the result of that war was that they took control of Spanish possessions anywhere in the world. And one of those was Cuba, another was Puerto Rico, one was Guam, the island of Guam, and fourthly was the Philippines. But they bought the Philippines from the Spanish for something like $20 million. And it became an American colony, probably really the only American colony ever in the world and in the history of the world was the Philippines. And they governed the Philippines until 1946, just after World War II. But the arrival of the Americans meant then the arrival of Protestant missionaries from the Philippines, Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, Brethren, Disciples of Christ. You had this slew of missionaries from different American denominations that arrived in the Philippines, and they were there and set up camp by the turn of the century, 1900. And so began the era of Protestant missionaries and Protestant churches in the Philippines. And then came World War II, and after World War II, 1946, they gained their independence. The Philippines gained their independence from the United States. And then after that, missionaries came from all parts of the world, no longer just from the United States. And so you had the mission that we belong to, OMF, arrived in 1951. And of course, their members were from all parts of the world, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the UK, and Holland, and Germany, and Switzerland, and all of these places. And the same, you had mission organizations such as New Tribes Mission, Assemblies of God. You had this multiplication of Protestant mission to the Philippines and all establishing churches across the islands, to the extent that today you have an evangelical church in the Philippines which numbers somewhere between 10 and 12 million. Sounds a fantastic number. It's about 10 to 12% of the nation, because they have about 100 million people. That's the population of the Philippines. So it has grown, and it is vibrant, and it continues to grow. Perhaps the sector of Philippine Protestantism that has grown most is the Pentecostal and the charismatic wing of the church, and they have thrived and multiplied. And in many ways, people have lost count as to how well they're doing. We arrived in the Philippines in 1989. This is a picture of us. We always traveled by motorcycle. We have only two children at this time. So it's before 1996, when our third was born. And it's, that motorcycle I only had for about a year. So it must be, I reckon, that photograph about 1990, 1991, somewhere around there. And we lived and worked amongst these people called the Manobo, up in the hills of the island of Mindanao, inaccessible through four-wheel vehicles. You had to use motorcycle or you had to walk. And it really was an adventure living on Mindanao. This is the island of Mindanao. This is the second largest island in the Philippines, right down in the south. And that little area there, shaded in red, is where we and our colleagues, not just us, of course, because we were members of a larger team, we served amongst the Manobo people who lived here in the central highlands of the island of Mindanao. Now, the islands, or that this part of Mindanao is, and the highland area of Mindanao, is really beautiful. It used to be, of course, all completely covered in rainforest. It was one dense thicket of rainforest from east to west, from north to south, until they started logging the hills and taking these logs off to sell in Japan and in Europe and places like that. And so for a long time, the Manobo people had lived in the mountains, in the forests, isolated from life at the coasts where the cities and the main towns were and the large population centres. But as the logging progressed through the 1960s and the 1970s, those logging roads meant that people from the lowlands, people who lived at the coast, could now use these logging roads, not just to get in and buy logs, but to get in and buy land and to build a house. And so the Manobo people who'd been isolated for so long became mixed with the lowland people. But today, still for the most part, the Manobo are those who live in the highlands. People from the lowlands came up, and only the really hardy ones could survive, because there was no electricity, there's no running water, and only those who liked the idea of a challenge, living in those hills and farming in those hills. Land was cheap, so that was the big attraction. But you had to really be determined to stay living there. You had to be a missionary or someone who just likes the hard life. Our priority, of course, was church planting and establishing Manobo churches. And that's what we spent our time and our energy doing. The Manobo Bible Church of Association, Manobo Bible Church Association of Mindanao, and I'm just going to use the term MABCAM for short, was formed in 1985. So that was about 4 years before we arrived in the Philippines. And it was our predecessors, those who had arrived to serve amongst the Manobo before us, they were the ones responsible for the pioneer work amongst the Manobo. They got it started and going. And by 1985, they had 11 small churches. And they formed this association. Now they have 60 plus churches. And they're in three different provinces in central Mindanao. So the growth amongst Manobo communities, the growth of Manobo churches, has been really encouraging and has been a real work of God. And we give thanks for that, and we give thanks for you and your prayers and your part in seeing that happen. But our lives were spent with one particular group called the Tigwa Manobo, and we had a little house in a village called Kibungkog. And from there, we continued to moved into different villages to preach the gospel, and we had a little classroom in the village that we lived in where we taught and trained Manobo evangelists and church leaders. And they were the ones who did the lion's share of the work. They were the ones who left their village and would go and live in a new village and become an evangelist and a church planter there. So we were part of a process of spreading the gospel amongst the Manobo. When I went back in for a visit in 2014, I made two visits for my research in 2014 and 2015. 2015 was the 30th anniversary of MUBCAM, and it took place in April. And I was there at the time, and so I was invited to come along and to speak and to be part of the celebrations. And this was a wonderful occasion for a number of reasons. Firstly, because of the growth of the church, by this stage, like I said already, it had reached about 60 churches, okay, more than 60 churches. And the total membership, well, it's hard to know what the membership is, somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 members. Manobo aren't interested in keeping very accurate lists and numbers of how many members belong to each congregation, but probably somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 is about right. And so each congregation was invited to send people to this 30-year anniversary. And I was there. Now, there were about maybe 700 or 800 people at this anniversary. Fantastic occasion. Really wonderful. And they bought all this cheap tarpaulin. You can see all this blue tarpaulin that they bought very cheaply. And they went into people's gardens and they cut down some bamboo poles. And those are the uprights that keep the thing in the shape of a large tent. And this is where they had all the meetings. This is where they had the times of singing and Bible readings and celebration. And the young people, those who at this time were still at high school, some of them came in traditional Manobo dress, and they performed special dances and drama. And we had teams washing dishes and preparing food. And then we had these lines of people serving food. There in the foreground of the picture, you can see these big basins full of little plastic bags. Each little plastic bag is a portion of rice and a portion of vegetables. So people would queue up and just lift one of these little bags onto their plate and move on and get their meat, get their chicken and their beef or their pork down at a different queue. And the importance of this is to make a very important point. This event was totally organized by the Manobo Christians themselves. It was a real logistical challenge. Previous to this, when we were still living amongst the Manobo and our colleagues, if something like this was going to happen, we were always having these all-believers conferences and Bible conferences, as they called them. We as the missionaries had to really do all the work. And it really was an awful lot of work. And we had to, you know, have a plan. We had to have a strategy. We had to have committees. We had to find finances to make these things happen. On this occasion, the Manobo did everything. And we as the missionaries, we were invited to come along and join if we wanted to. And we were allowed to speak. That's something that shows that the Manobo Church have reached a maturity. That means they're now largely independent of of missionary help and missionary advice and so on. They're able to lead, to govern their own church association. They're also now planning their own outreach, evangelism, church planting, doing their own theological training. And it really was a joy to be at this and to be able to see this happen. This is the creche. The children are wrapped up in blankets and hung on poles. Once they get tired and start to get crabbits, you put them in this, and so someone comes along, gives it a shake now and again if anybody cries, in the hope that that helps to keep them quiet. So this is I snuck around the corner and caught this picture of the children sleeping. On the left is the MABCAM president, Albert Katua. His father was one of the founding members of the Church Association of MABCAM. So he was one of those in 1985 who signed a document that gave birth to this church association. Now his son is president of the association. A fantastic young man, good Bible teacher. He's organized, he's got great vision, and he's a superb leader. And these second generation believers are going to lead MABCAM in a new direction. We used to attend these meetings. They would have business meetings, you know, a bit like the General Assembly. They would have an equivalent of that every year. And we used to go along to these in the past when we lived there in the 90s and in the early 2000s. And you lost the will to live sitting in these meetings. It really was horrendous at times. We would be there for days. And you would, at the end of it, wonder, what did we achieve? What did we decide? We didn't decide anything. We talked forever about every single agenda item, but I don't remember any decisions being made. And anyway, we went to a meeting. When we went back in 2010, we went back for a two-year period, and we were at one of these Bible conferences. Went very well, superb. And after that, there was a meeting, a business meeting. And it was to start at 8 o'clock in the morning, so we thought that means we don't need to be there until 8:45. So we wandered up 45 minutes after the start time, because our experience was the start time didn't really mean anything. It was more a suggestion that you start at 8 o'clock. So we went up 8:45, and they'd already been going 3/4 of an hour and had got 3 or 4 business items done. And I says, what is going on? Why are you started already? Well, we did say we would start at 8 o'clock. And then afterwards, I got talking to Albert, and I says, so how you do these business meetings very differently now? Oh, he says, yes, you know, he says, we appreciate our parents, our uncles, and those men now, many of whom have passed away, because we owe them the birth of MABCAM. And they believed the gospel in hard times, and they stood their ground. And they were faithful to the Lord and to the gospel. And we're standing on their shoulders. But we vowed we would never conduct meetings the way they conducted meetings, he said. We say we start at 8 o'clock, we start at 8 o'clock. If we say we're going to stop for lunch at 12, we stop for lunch at 12. And we finish in the afternoon at 4 o'clock and so on. And we suddenly realized when we went back in 2010 for those 2 years that these men are going to take this church association in a new direction. They have energy, they're well organized, and they love the Lord as their parents did. And that really, really is very, very encouraging. To the right there, you have a young friend of ours, Jimmy Lumasai, who's preaching a sermon across the airwaves in a radio station, preaching the gospel, and it's going out into to villages where there is no pastor on the airwaves. And we have lots of things, therefore, to give thanks to God for the growth of these churches. The fact that Manobo evangelists are planting new churches. Manobo church leaders are doing theological training for new believers and church planters and missionaries and pastors. And that is something that we give thanks to God for. We give thanks for our time there, for being a part of that, a small part of that, the pleasure and the privilege of being involved in training and discipling young men and young women. We also have seen many of our young people graduate from high school and go on to college. Some of them have trained as rural midwives. Now, a midwife is not what we think of as a midwife here, someone who works in a hospital and whose primary concern is helping women to deliver children and provide antenatal care and so on. A rural midwife there is really like a rural health worker. And they're responsible for seeing that all children in the village are vaccinated against disease. They're responsible for seeing that everyone practices health care in their home and hygiene in the home to prevent disease. But they also are responsible for prenatal and antenatal classes for women. And they do help at the delivery of newborn babies. But they're general health care workers. Many of our young people went on to college and trained to be health care workers. Many went on and trained to be school teachers. And when we first started this program back in the 80s, we were criticized by a number of people who said, you know, those young people, to get those qualifications, they need to go to the city. And when they go to the city and when they graduate, they'll not be coming back to the mountains. They'll not want anything to do with life amongst the Manobo. You know, the bright lights and the activity of the city and the attraction and the appeal of the cities will mean they never come home. But, you know, not a single one of those young people stayed and remained in the cities. As soon as they graduated, they were straight back to the hills. They have a genuine burden and love for their own people. And they're back serving as midwives, healthcare workers, and as school teachers in the government schools in the villages. We also have one young woman who graduated 3 or 4 years ago as a doctor. So we have a Manobo as a doctor and another young man who's currently studying to be a doctor. Again, something truly, truly wonderful to give thanks for. I want to move on, however, and talk about this place. We are not returning to work amongst the Manobo. We're going to be teaching this place here, Koinonia Theological Seminary, and that's in Davao City. This is the map that I showed earlier. The little bit of red in the center is where we lived and worked previously. Now we're going to be in Davao City, which is just a little bit south of that on the coast. Davao would be the largest city on the island of Mindanao, perhaps the main city on the island itself. Davao City is famous for this man here. Does anyone know who this is? Well, I've got it written, of course, there. It's President Duterte. The current president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, was formerly the mayor of Davao City. If you've been watching the news, particularly if you ever watch Al Jazeera, which gives good news bulletins from Asia, this man's face and what this man has been up to as president of the Philippines will have been featured there. He went from being mayor of Davao City to being president of the entire nation of the Philippines. A very unusual jump. I mean, to be a mayor is quite a prestigious job, but it's a long way from being president. Normally, a man or woman who becomes president has previously been a congressman, a congresswoman, or a senator. Most likely that you're a senator before you become a president. But this man went from being mayor to being president because of what happened in Davao City. Davao City was at one time a place full of violence, full of guns and drugs, an unsafe place to live, an unsafe place to do business, not a great place to raise a family. Deaths by the dozen every week. It really was a war zone. And he cleaned it up. He used very strong arm tactics. He used very brutal methods. He armed the militias to deal with the communist rebels in the shanty towns. He armed groups and says, you know who the rebels are where you live. We're going to give you guns and you can go in and deal with those people as you see fit. So it was a bloody place for a while. It really was a horrendous moment in the life of Davao City. But eventually things settled down. It became a peaceful place. He also used very unorthodox and very brutal methods to try and stop the drugs, proliferation of drugs in Davao City, and seems to have done a good job there also. And because he cleaned up Davao City, he became popular throughout the whole country and was elected as president in 2016. So he would be Davao City's most famous son. And when he became president of the Philippines, he decided to wage war on drugs. That this was the country's greatest threat. It was a menace that had gotten completely out of hand. And basically he gave the police authority to deal with the drug menace as they saw fit, and there would be no repercussions. So since 2016, some 10,000 to 12,000 people have been killed in the president's crusade on drugs. So every week, I follow the Philippine news on certain websites, and there are reports every week of men found dead at the side of the street because they were drug takers or drug dealers. And it's a very sad situation. It's a very brutal tactic to employ to address a problem which is a malicious problem, which is a threat to the stability, of course, of any country, as a threat to family life. And we're aware of the menace that drugs is to the life of any individual or family or community. It is truly a threat to the quality of life. But what has happened in the Philippines, what is happening at the minute in this crusade on drugs, is really sad and is tragic beyond all proportion. It really is an awful situation that we're in at the moment in the Philippines. So, KTS, why are we going to teach in this seminary? You know, some people, when I tell them we're not going back to the Manubo, we're going to be teaching in this seminary, they think, some of them say it out loud to me, that doesn't sound terribly interesting. Wilson, why do you want to do that? I mean, what you did before out in those mountains, taking the gospel, being involved in that movement of the gospel going into villages, that's real missionary work. I mean, that's like what the Apostle Paul did. He was always, you know, reaching for that place which didn't yet have a church where there were no believers, those cities. That's what real missionary work is like. And why are you going to teach in this college? What's that about? Is that not a step in the wrong direction? Well, there are a number of reasons why we think it's best not to return to work amongst the Manubo. Basically, what I've shared with you already in that little report earlier, the Manubo churches no longer need full-time missionaries. Manubo Christians, Manubo churches have grown up, and for them it's time to cut those strings, those connections with missionaries. Not completely, of course. We still have a very good relationship with Manubo leaders and churches. But it's a bit like in your families. Member of the family gets to a certain age where they feel the need to leave home. That's because they're going to get married. Perhaps they're going off to university. They've got a job in another part of the country. And it's time to leave. That dependency on mother and father is never going to be the same again. It's not going to be of the same intensity. There's going to be, of course, strong bonds of love and affection and friendship. But the dependency is not what it was. And it's the same for Manubo Christians. They are now no longer as dependent on missionaries, OMF missionaries, as they once were. So for us to return would be in many ways counterproductive. These people have grown up, they're managing without us. Let's continue to be friends and to encourage them, but let them get on with leading their own churches and evangelizing and church planting themselves. Christian churches are also, not just in the Philippines, but across the whole of East Asia where OMF works, Christian churches are increasingly wanting missionaries, as is written here on the screen, who will work with them and under their leadership. They're not calling so much any longer for the pioneer like the Apostle Paul, who goes out into the great unknown and evangelizes on his own independently. They're wanting people who will come and work with their leadership, will work with their agenda and what they want to see happen. And that's why I read this evening about the life of Apollos. Apollos arrived in Ephesus. There was already a church there planted by Paul. And he was willing to help and to teach there. He was also a very learned man, okay? That's what that passage in Acts 18 said. He was a learned man, well-versed in the scriptures. And yet he was willing to be taken aside by Priscilla and Aquila to be taught something more. They realized that what he was preaching and teaching wasn't quite right. He knew only the baptism of John. And so they said, this man needs some help. He needs his message refined. He needs some further theological education and assistance. And he was willing to bow to the authority of these two people, Priscilla and Aquila, and listen to what they had to say and to learn from them. There's humility. There's a man who's willing to be a partner. He was then willing to leave Ephesus and to go to Corinth. Now, Corinth, there was already a church there, which the Apostle Paul had planted. And that's why you have Paul saying in 1 Corinthians 3, I planted the seed, Apollos watered it. Apollos didn't feel, I've got to be the man who's there first, who starts the church, who's the pioneer, who does the evangelism. So they'll always remember that church was started by Apollos. Apollos is willing to come in as the second act to help in a work that's already been started by someone else. And that again speaks of his humility, his willingness to be a helper. And that's what our brothers and sisters leading churches in East Asia want. They want missionaries with that attitude, willing to be helpers, willing to do jobs that really need doing, whether or not it suits the missionary or not. So that's another reason we're not returning as workers amongst the Manobo, why we're not returning to a pioneer situation. We are also changing as a couple. We're both now in our 50s. Living out in the hills amongst the Manobo is actually very hard on the body. It really is a strain. And it has been exciting, has been an adventure. And the hills are beautiful. And walking the hills is terrific. But we have certain pains in certain parts of our body that might never go away unless we treat ourselves a little bit more gently. So for us, it seems a good time to be moving into the cities and doing something that doesn't perhaps require so much strain upon our own bodies. And when we were there this past summer, we went in August because we were given the option of two places, KTS in Davao and another institution in Manila. And before we went to visit, we'd been corresponding by email with leaders in both places, and we couldn't make up our minds. So we said, let's just go and make a visit. So we did. We visited both places. And then we talked to OMF leaders, OMF colleagues. We talked to Filipino friends. And we said, these are the two options, one in Manila and one in Davao City, KTS in Davao City. We talked to maybe a dozen friends and colleagues, and every single one of them said, we think you should be in Davao. That's the place you should serve. It's got so much potential, and they really need help. But it's a place that's going to grow in its importance in years to come. So the visit helped us to understand that God was leading us to KTS, and that's the place where we should be and will be serving in years to come. Just by way of introduction to what KTS is, Julie and Sam Bustamante, Julie to the right, Dr. Julie Bustamante is the seminary director, and her husband to the left is also full-time as a lecturer in the college. They, plus one other individual, are the only full-time staff in the college. KTS is a place that's training Christians from the island of Mindanao for mission and for church leadership. And the second point there in the screen says it was created to stop the brain drain to Manila. The brightest and the best Christians in Mindanao, if they wanted to go on to do further studies, to improve their training and their qualifications, used to just have to go to Manila. Okay, 500 miles north. It's like flying from Belfast to London. And often when they graduated, they got jobs there and they never returned to Mindanao. So if we have a good institution, a good training facility in Davao City, it will stop the need for people having to go to Manila, from which they may never return and often have not returned in the past. It's a place for students who want to learn to think Christianly, who want to learn to think theologically about their own context in Mindanao. I've talked there about the president and the violence and the deaths in the Philippines in recent months and in the past 2 years because of the president's crusade against drugs. That has got Christians talking. And I meet Christians in Mindanao we met so many this time, who says, this is great. The president's doing a good job. Yeah, we may not like everything that's happening, but, you know, he's dealing with drugs. He's dealing with the communist rebels. He's dealing with the Muslim rebels. He's taking no nonsense. This is good for our island, good for our country. And yet there are other Christians writing articles in newspapers and also speaking out and saying, this is awful. This is just completely unacceptable that we have this carnage. We have this slaughter in our streets month after month. Can any of us imagine Jesus Christ endorsing this kind of leadership, this approach to running a country? And so what is happening at the Philippines at the current time has created a lot of theological debate and Christians thinking and discussing what is happening and trying to make sense of it in light of the scriptures. And so KTS wants to be a place like this where Christians can come and learn to think using the scriptures about their own context in the Philippines. What has God's word got to say about this? How do we make sense of this in the light of the scriptures? And many of them also come to train for Muslim mission in the Philippines. We have about 4 million Muslims in the Philippines. Most of them live in Mindanao. And these students regularly who come to KTS want to be equipped for working amongst Muslims, sharing the gospel, preaching and teaching amongst Muslims. And they want to be ready for that and equipped for that. And of course, KTS is well placed to do that, being a seminary in Mindanao. There are certain needs, and I'm going to finish with this slide. There are certain needs, and you can go on, please, praying for us as we go to this place, and please pray for the college itself. It's under-resourced. Like I said, there are only 3 full-time staff members, so we will put those numbers up to 5. And, of course, coming in as missionaries, they don't need to pay us. We come as missionaries with our own support. They don't need to find us a salary. That means we're not a burden upon their resources, their financial resources. So that's hopefully something that makes life a little easier for them and increases their capacity to receive more students. Numbers are growing, but the building is small and the building is quite old. They have 52 students at the moment, but the building is really not fit for purpose. They don't have sufficient classroom space. They can't extend sideways. They can't extend on ground level. They're going to have to perhaps knock the building down and put up a new one, which might be 2, 3, 4 stories high. Only something like that is going to increase their capacity for receiving more students. And other problems with the building, when there's heavy rain, water comes up through the floor, and that's not good for the premises either. And the library's on the ground floor, so when there's heavy rain, you have to go around and lift all the books off the bottom shelves, put them on tables, make sure they don't get soaking. It's not an ideal situation. You know what I mean when I say the building is not fit for purpose. And standards of excellence, when there have only been 3 full-time staff members who work from morning to night just to keep the place running, then the standards are not perhaps always what they should be. They're just getting by. They're getting people through their courses. They're getting people graduated. But perhaps the quality of experience for the student in the classroom is not what it could be or should be because people are overworked, under-resourced, and understaffed. So please, can you continue to pray for us and continue to pray for KTS? We're planning to return next year at the end of March. That's what we're thinking at the moment. You never know, we might be back down with you again in Kilkeel before that. Let's pray together. Our Father God, we give you thanks for KTS as a place that someone had the vision to get going in 1994. And we thank you for the students that have been trained there and now serving on Mindanao in churches. Think of one young girl who's now serving as a missionary in Vietnam, a graduate of KTS. And we pray that it will be a place that continues to train more and more Filipino Christians from the island of Mindanao and equip them for mission and church leadership